Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, your home for stock market news and ideas to help you beat high inflation by getting you investing for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva, and a very warm welcome to episode 9 of series 5. I hope you are all very well. We've got a jam-packed episode as always. We're going to be going back to, not really basics, but the beginning, really, which, and this is something that you can very easily retrofit as well if you're already investing, and that's how we go about forming an investment plan and sticking to it. So we've got our resident expert, chartered financial planner Felix Milton, back onto the pod to talk to us about this. And basically it involves the sort of all the preparatory bits that are very useful to do before you get going in the stock market. So forming some goals, thinking about risk, preparing your finances, things like protection, and then developing a bit of a plan, thinking about where you're going to invest the right sorts of assets relative to the goals that you're trying to achieve, and then at the end of that, reviewing your portfolios as well. So all that kind of lovely stuff. It just gives you a bit of a mechanism for which to kind of do this methodically and make sure you're sort of on track to what you want to achieve. And it's certainly something that a financial advisor would do with you, and we can do a sort of basic version of this ourselves. So I think a really useful podcast today. Elsewhere, we're going to also, of course, as always, have a look at what's going on in markets. We have what's the Fed has been doing in the US, so the central bank there, and the election they're also having and the impact that's kind of having on markets. We're also going to see what the Bank of England has been deciding here as it follows up from Fed moves, and also how the property market is faring in the UK following Trussonomics and some of that disastrous mini budget. In our explainer section, we're going to have a little look at what's been driving a really quite grim crypto market this year. It's in a complete bear market, so we're going to be analysing a little bit about what has been going on there. And then finally, in companies, we're going to shoot through some headlines really and have a little look at what's been going on at Meta, at Twitter, Made.com, and also WeWork. Now, please, please, please share this with friends if you're enjoying the pod. And many thanks to our sponsors, Janice Henderson Investors, for their support, helping us educate and inform private investors. Okay, let's start with the markets over the fortnight and what I've been chatting to the analysts at Hargreaves Lansdown about. Well, we'll begin with the US. I think in general there, of course, we're seeing, as is the case with a lot of markets, that the central bank, the Federal Reserve, is playing a big part in market movements. Last week, a lot of focus was on what the Fed was going to do with interest rates. And surprise, surprise, it was another bump, a 0.75% rise that came through. So that was expected. But the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, also said that he thought higher interest rates would hang around for longer than what the market was sort of expecting. So they did drop on that. And in particular, as has generally been the case with rising interest rates, tech got pretty punished in that environment, as a lot of tech companies have a fair chunk of their value based on the fact that a lot of their profits are in the future. So analysts sort of have a look at, you know, what they're going to do in the future, and they think it's going to be very good, and they kind of discount that to get a value today. That the higher interest rates go, the more they discount that cash. So every time it goes up, the values tend to sort of go down because those future cash flows are less valuable. So the tech-heavy Nasdaq stock market over in the US had a pretty harsh sell-off after that. Since then, there's sort of been a bounce back, and there's been sort of pretty conflicting signals really about inflation and therefore what the Fed is likely to do in the coming months. And recent data, well, we saw unemployment that has risen more than expected. So, you know, when employment is very good and unemployment is low, then that creates what they call tight labour market conditions, which is not great for inflation. So when unemployment rises, that seemed to be a bit of a release on some of that inflationary pressure. Also, we saw that actual inflation figures falling to their lowest level since January, so at 7.7%. So it's sort of, it's pointing then that the Fed might go, oh, inflation is beginning to come off the boil. We may not need to continue with, you know, such big rises, or we may not need to hold interest rates as high for as long. So there seems to have been some good news from share prices off the back of that. The other big thing, I think, in the US is the election midterms. So stocks have been actually rising a little bit on the back of the fact that the expectation was Republicans would quite convincingly take both the Senate and the House of Representatives, both houses of the legislative arm, and you know, that kind of more right-wing Republican side of things is generally seen as is easier on business. So in particularly with regulations around sectors such as energy and also drug pricing in pharmaceuticals as well. So some of those stocks in those sectors have been rising. But at the time of recording, we were very near the completion of all of it. But what is, so it's not quite finished yet. The final votes are still being counted. But what's quite clear is that no red, big red wave has materialized. So that's interesting. I think still though, from a market perspective, if we end up, you know, the likelihood still really is that both houses will end up tipping into Republican favor. So we'll have a red legislative arm and we'll have a blue executive. So that will obviously stall a lot of laws going through. And on that basis, markets probably are not so, you know, they don't mind that so much. They're fairly sanguine about that. So that's not necessarily a bad thing from a market perspective, but, you know, we might see some volatility as we get near to that debt ceiling again, which I'm sure many of you will remember from the Obama era. And it depends on the kind of brinkmanship that is played, if it plays out like that. In the UK, the Bank of England has followed its cousin, the Fed, raising its key interest rates by 0.75% to 3%. And it also came with a warning from the bank, which said, we are likely to experience the longest recession upcoming since the 1920s. So that's quite a dreary sort of outlook. And it said the hit to income will be around £800 a year to the average household. But unfortunately, in particular, it's going to affect that bottom 10% of households in terms of earnings, because they spend the biggest proportion of their income on utilities and food. And that's where a lot of the big price rises have been concentrated, and where a lot of the source of this more broad inflation has sort of come from. So that's not a great news. And they also pointed that in particular, the problem is a tight labour market, which I mentioned earlier. So there's not enough people for jobs, really. And I'll leave it to your interpretation as to why that might be the case. We're also seeing the property market slow a little bit too. October showed that price rises were up 7.2% year on year, which of course is still a rise. It still seems fairly high, but actually that's a big slowdown, big climb down from the 9.5% that we saw in September. And of course, the cause is this fairly, well-noted disastrous mini-budget, which battered the mortgage market. And you know, it does seem to be coming off. The effects of that do seem to be wearing off, but that's a big, big part of why that's the case. In China, there's a lot of hope around, you know, that the Communist Party will get rid of this really harsh zero COVID policy. It's having a big effect on supply chains around the world. But officials have poured cold water on that idea more recently. That said, you know, markets sort of whipsawed off the back of that, but they still are kind of broadly betting that eventually the party will call off that policy. And we saw actually the impact of the, you know, on supply chains on one of the world's biggest companies, and that's Apple. Its results and sales of its new iPhone 14, which have been successful, are being crimped by slow production in its Chinese factories, particularly the Foxconn factories in Zhengzhou. It has also weakened oil a little bit as well, because China is a massive consumer of energy, and that's competing against the production cuts that were announced by OPEC members quite recently. So yeah, that's just this sort of causing this balancing effect in markets. All in all, the FTSE 100 is up 4.24% to 7,375 points. The S&P 500 is up 2.47% to 3,902 points. The Stock 600 is up 5.33% to 432 points. And the Nikkei 225 is up 0.37% to 27,446 points. Okay, so let's get on to our little explainers section. And I thought I would take a look at what's been going on in the crypto markets this year, because it's been a torrid year for crypto assets, a bear market for sure. The total value of the market has lost trillions. And the latest news that we've been hearing on big liquidity issues at a big crypto exchange called FTX has meant that it's no longer worth even $1 trillion. So it's now worth about $860 billion. Now, big price swings are to be expected in crypto. Anyone investing in it will know this for sure. Why is that? Well, aside from the sort of short-term supply and demand dynamics of the underlying coins, it's very hard to assess what crypto assets are fundamentally worth. There's no basis of something to sort of value it with. There's no physical properties to it like gold or property. There's no intellectual property to it. There's no cash flow or profits from the operations or dividends or interest or anything like that. There's nothing for which analysts can base a value on. Ultimately, it's really a speculative bet on where the underlying technology, the distributed ledger technology, will take us, how important that's going to be in society, how it's going to be used, and which companies are going to be the leaders in supplying and delivering the outputs of that technology. So, when we go back a couple of decades ago and we had the dot-com boom and the advent of the internet, there were lots of companies out there doing all sorts of different things. And, there were some writing algorithms around search and ordering information. And, of course, Google was one of the ones that nailed it, and early investors were made very rich. So it's kind of got that nascency in the technology. So downturns are frequent, given that it doesn't have this easy ability to anchor the prices of the crypto assets with something that fundamentally values them as a particular value. So in 2018, we saw Bitcoin, the world's largest and well-known coin, lose 80%, which is a pretty big loss, really, and then sort of recover out of that. And, back at that time, 2017, 2018, it was because we were seeing a lot of new coins being launched and a lot of speculation around it, a lot of hype around the industry, and that bubble kind of popped. This year, it's been a slightly different thing. So beginning in 2021, we saw the regulators starting to tighten the screws a little bit on the crypto Wild West as they began to worry about what they saw as increasing numbers of consumers in that space and speculators and the potential for financial loss. So they started to move in on the space a little bit more. So, for example, we saw the Security and Exchange Commission in the US take up a lawsuit against Ripple. We saw China banning mining and sending lots of crypto miners out of the country, sort of examples of that. Also, what's different is the economy has turned now. Inflation is obviously gotten quite high. Interest rates have been raised in response. And because crypto markets are quite correlated to mainstream markets, as the lights go off on that desire to take risks, on investors' appetite for risk assets, then lots of those riskier stuff gets dumped. Shares obviously have been doing poorly for that reason, and crypto have sort of been doing poorly as well, as investors sort of broadly move their sort of asset allocation away from sort of riskier assets too. So that's definitely had an effect. Also, for retail investors, tighter monetary conditions, rising interest rates, cost of living crisis, all sorts of things like that is reducing their spare cash and their ability to invest in these sorts of things anyway. In the professional world as well, what we're hearing is that there's been quite a lot of leveraged positions in crypto assets as well. And when they fall, you tend to get margin calls. So that's when the lenders, the ones providing that leverage, that those loans to the big hedge funds and companies like that, ask them to put down more money, then as you do that, you then need to sell assets in order to raise that cash to be able to put down those and meet the margin calls. So we've definitely seen that, and that exacerbates selling and further price falls as well. And finally, the rout has sort of been exacerbated recently by big liquidity problems at a big exchange called FTX. And, that's rattled markets even more. Binance, the other big exchange, was supposedly going to step in and save it, which would have ended up with 80% of the market, but that's been called off. So suddenly FTX's chief, a guy called Sam Bankman-Fried, has lost 94% of his wealth in a week, which equates to over $15 billion, which is the biggest loss for any person in history in that time frame, which I thought was quite interesting. So not a great market, really. If it's something you want to do, fair enough. I mean, we've always said only in very small amounts and be prepared to lose it all. At the moment, people look at falling markets and they think, oh, what great value. Well, there's a saying, it's like trying to catch a falling knife. It's difficult to call the bottom of markets and know where they're going to go. So, just be very aware of that, I think. I read an interesting article in The Guardian about a teacher who had really gone heavy into this and used up a lot of life savings and managed to get, so spent about $50,000, got up to about $300,000. So life-changing amounts of money, really. And last time he checked, he had $5,000. Okay, on to companies. In tech, we heard Meta are going to lay off 11,000 jobs, or 13% of its workforce, as competition continues to be intense with the likes of other platforms like TikTok. It's also going to moderate its investment in the metaverse. The digital advertising is not having a great time of it recently. We're seeing inflation and interest rate rises really crimp budgets at lots of companies, and they're really pulling back from advertising at those platforms, which is really affecting their core source of revenues. This seems to have appeased investors a little bit. They were quite concerned at the cash burn at Meta, and we saw some share prices rise there. Elon Musk finally completed his much talked about deal with Twitter and set about firing 3,700 of its employees, or around 50% of its workforce. He also started laying the groundwork for his future plans. The company is looking at charging a monthly fee of $7.99 for its premium blue accounts, its verified blue ticks. He's also floating ideas around fintech payments as well, so bringing in savings accounts, debit transactions, peer-to-peer loans, that kind of thing as well. May.com as well, it fell into administration this week, just 18 months after it floated on the stock market, which was certainly a sad demise. It had suffered very much under the pandemic, had to change its operational model from just in time to sort of building up stock closer to home. This, unfortunately, what it does is it ties up a lot of capital. And this came just at the point as demand started to come off the boil due to the recent economic slowdown. And that was it, really, enough of a crunch. So, yeah, sad there, really. Next, have bought it out of pre-pack administration for £3.4 million, which is quite remarkable, really, when you consider it floated for £775 million. So, tough game. And finally, WeWork is shutting some of its underperforming offices in the US to save on costs, about 5% of them. This comes just a year after they went public. This is as the relatively new chief executive, Sandeep Mathrani, cuts the excessive splurging that went on under its former boss, the founder, Adam Neumann, as he tries to convince investors how he can get the company towards profitability. It once had a private market valuation of $47 billion. It's now valued in the public markets at $1.8 billion. Okay, let's get on to our interview with Felix. The temptation with investing is to jump right in, but as with all things, a bit of planning and strategic thinking beforehand is going to lead to better outcomes. And of course, with our finances, that's pretty important. So today, we're going to take a little look at forming an investment plan and thinking about some of the things you need to do to prepare your finances. Of course, as always, we have some expertise to tap into. And back on the pod is a series regular financial advisor, Felix Milton from Philip J. Milton & Company. Felix, a very warm welcome to you.
Hello.
Felix, should we start just by reminding people, also any new listeners as well, you're a chartered financial planner. What exactly is this?
So I basically help people make their money work for them to achieve the goals they want to achieve in their life. So that's my job in a nutshell, if you like.
Okay, brilliant. So and it goes a bit beyond just thinking about stock market investments, doesn't it? You deal with many aspects of people's finances.
Yes. So it's even the little things down to sort of financial coaching, making sure that they're making the right decisions and not doing anything irrational. To also selecting the products that they are ultimately invested in or the cash accounts that they have their savings in. So it's a pretty broad brush.
And presumably chartered means you've done just a lot of exams over your time.
Yes, effectively. Many, many exams. I can't remember the exact number, but probably about 15.
Okay, well, let's get into what we're essentially doing today is forming an investment plan. But before that, the first thing you kind of need to do is to understand your financial position. Is that right?
Yes. So I view this first step as, imagine that all your money and assets were in a piggy bank. And you need to take the bottom off that piggy bank and shake it all out onto the table. Because until you know exactly what you've got and what you're dealing with, you can't make a good plan for the future. So you really need to know what you've got before you start doing any planning. Just where am I now? So coming up with that position is really important.
Okay. Is there an easy way to do this?
So really, I create a simple spreadsheet and simply list all my assets. So my cash accounts, my investment accounts, my pension accounts, my house, and then simultaneously list all my liabilities. So my mortgage, my car loan, you know, any sort of things like that. And then I'd also list things like my life insurance, any in-work benefits that I get, my medical insurance and things like that. So have that all listed down so you know what you're working with. And that would be the first step.
Okay. And what about things like your cash flow?
So cash flow is a really, really good one. So most people have a pretty consistent budget. So month by month, they know exactly what they're working with. So if you haven't got a budget or haven't drawn up a budget, I really encourage you to use one of the myriad free budget planners that are out there. And simply go through your income and your expenditure and see what you've got left at the end of the month. Because again, when you're coming up with a plan and you want to make sure your money's working as hard as possible for you, it's much better to have a plan as to where that spare income is going, or if there is no spare income, how you're addressing that shortfall, because that's what you need to come up with a comprehensive solution for everything.
Okay. And then, you know, stock market investments are risky. So what about cash that you sort of need to have on hand? I suppose a rainy day fund. Is this a wise idea?
Yeah, rainy day funds are always a really good idea. So your rainy day fund is viewed as something that you can access immediately to cover any unforeseen expenditure. So that may be that, imagine your car needs its MOT and you think it's going to pass fine, but actually it needs a significant amount of work. That would be where the rainy day fund is dipped into. And typically that's something that you should have between maybe 3 and 6 months worth of expenditure for someone who's working. If you're retired, it's a bit different because usually you'll have some sort of pension income in a guaranteed manner. So you need less of that dependence on, am I going to be able to afford this if I say I can't work or for whatever reason? So it's really personal how much you hold back. But usually if you're in work, between 3 and 6 months regular expenditure is really good to hold in a rainy day fund.
What about credit cards?
Credit cards can also be used as a rainy day fund, particularly if you've got a 0% purchase credit card, because that means that effectively you can spend a lump sum in one go and knowing that you're not going to pay in any interest on that balance. You just need to be careful to make sure that you clear that balance by the end of the 0% period. But yeah, they're a really great way of, if you don't want to have that rainy day fund, knowing that you've got access to effectively free capital is really helpful. So if you're struggling to build that rainy day fund or don't have anything now, getting a 0% credit card and not using it, apart from if any rainy day expenditures come up, is really, really wise.
Okay, so that's sort of step one, I suppose. And then the next up, we kind of need to think about some financial goals. Now, do you want to explain what these are and then maybe what some typical goals are for younger, maybe more middle-aged people and then older groups as well?
Yeah, so financial goals are, you know, quite like they do what they say on the tin almost. If you have a financial goal, I want to buy a house in 5 years' time that's going to cost me £400,000. That's a very clear financial goal. You've got a target that you want to aim for and a time frame to get there. So that would be a clear financial goal. Other ones would be, I want to retire in a number of years' time on an income of £30,000 a year, for example. So again, another very clear financial goal. And as you go through life, you'll find that your financial goals and priorities change. So typically in the younger demographics, we will see the major financial goal is I want to buy and own my first home. That's a really key one for the younger demographic as they're just setting out on their careers and so on. It may be that they want to increase their salary to a level where they can, you know, go on nicer holidays as well and things like that. So they're really starting out. When you're more middle-aged, there's probably things like I have a financial goal of I want to save for my children. So I want to ensure that they can go to a good university when they get to the age of 18, or I want to send them to private school that's going to cost this amount of money per year. So that's another sort of financial goal that's quite typical for a middle-aged person. And then for the older groups of people, it may be those that are approaching retirement, as I sort of said earlier, have a target of I want an income of, say, two-thirds of my employed income, or £30,000 a year when I get to retirement. And I also have a goal of I want to give this much away in my life to my family, or I want to go on this once in a lifetime holiday that's going to cost X thousand pounds and things like that. So they're typically the different goals that you get across the generations. But that's not to say that younger, middle-aged and older groups can have goals that are, you know, interchangeable between them.
All sorts of different goals. And you can, and you'll often have multiple goals running at any one time, right?
Exactly. I mean, even if you're younger and your overarching goal is to buy a house, you probably will have a goal in the back of your mind of I need to save for my retirement. I will need to make sure that I have that rainy day fund. I will need to save for my wedding, perhaps, or things like that. So you'll have a number of goals that you need to come up with. And what you need to do when you've come up with those goals is actually prioritize them and work out which is the most important and which is the least important. There may be some goals that you haven't considered how important they are until you've got them written down. It may be things like if you're in a long-term relationship, for example, if I die, how would my partner cope? So that's a really important goal that you may not prioritize. You might, oh, actually, I need to look at getting some life insurance just in case. So you know that that aspect is covered. So it's thinking about everything and every eventuality and writing it all down and then prioritizing these.
Okay. And then why does the time frame to these goals matter?
So the time frame matters because it depends on what you would set up and do to achieve the target. So say you've got an investment pot and you want to invest some money. If you're investing for your retirement, for example, you can probably say, oh, my goal is 30 years plus. So really, I can afford to take a bit more risk with that money because I know I'm not going to touch it for 30 years. If I know in 2 years' time I'm going to buy a house, I probably shouldn't be investing that money in the full extent, because I will need to access some in the short term. And if market volatility arises, then really I can't afford to invest all of it. So I might only invest a very small amount. So it would be that's why time frame comes into it, because you can really work out how much of your money you should be investing for any one of your goals.
Okay. And it's not just this split between, you know, relatively safe savings and then taking a bit more risk in investing. Within the investment world as well, there's a whole range of assets that all come with different risks. Am I right?
There are, yes. So you have your more defensive assets and then you have your more speculative assets. But you basically, investing should just be seen as taking a share of a company that you and I interact with on a daily basis. And if that company does well, you do well too. And over the long run, humans have always innovated, always evolved. Companies have come and go, but the general progression is upwards. So you want to benefit from that upwards growth. And that's why generally you invest.
Okay. And this is, now you're referring to stock market investments in company shares. Now that generally comes with a minimum sort of time frame that's recommended. What is that?
So the absolute minimum would probably be 5 years, but usually you're looking at 10 years plus.
Right, okay. And the reason for that is?
The reason for that is that sort of, as I said earlier, in that if your money falls, because stock markets do go up and down, and I can tell anyone who's listening to this podcast who hasn't invested, you will go through a point when you have less than you invested. It's very likely to happen. But markets go up and down over the long, but over the long run, they always go up. I can say that with absolute certainty because that's always what's happened in the past. And I have no reason to doubt that the future is going to be anything different to that because humans have always progressed and always innovated. So you need to sort of be aware of what you invest in. It will go down, but over the long run, it will go up. And the reason for that time frame is that if you invest and say those that invested for the first time at the end of December 2021, they will most likely be seeing losses now because the markets have fallen. But they need to remember to sort of bear with it and remain invested for the longer term, because over time, their money will grow and will be back above that level.
Okay, interesting. I think the other asset I just wanted to touch upon, I mean, there are, you know, a range of them and alternatives and various different assets like infrastructure. But I think that's for maybe a bit further down the road. It's a bit more complex. But the other big asset class is bonds. How would you approach thinking about bonds?
So bonds, for all those who are unaware of them, are effectively loans from companies or governments that are tradable on a stock market. So you have government bonds, and they are the safest form of bonds because generally governments don't go bust. It does happen, but if you're investing in a bond from the US, the UK, Germany, France, Japan, that typically the government's not going to default on making those payments. So you will basically be paid an income stream for basically loaning the government that money. And at the end of a set period, they will repay that money and you'll get your money back. So that's the safest type of investment. You have corporate bonds, which are loans to companies. Again, they are very, very safe if they're from the biggest companies in the world. So take Apple, for example, as the largest market capitalization company. If it issued a bond, chances are you're always going to get the interest and you're always going to get your repayment at the end of the bond period. So bonds offer that element of capital protection, because if you're investing in safe bonds, you know that regardless of what happens, you're going to get your money back after a set period. And you're also going to benefit from the interest that the governments pay for borrowing your money over that time.
OK, so this as an asset class is a bit safer than shares, and you're going to get a little bit of interest each year. You'll get repaid it. You know, if you stick all the way to the end, you'd get repaid that initial amount. But these are generally things that are kind of traded. But it means that the price of them doesn't move around so much. The volatility tends to be lower than shares, but so does also the returns tend to be lower.
Yes, the volatility tends to be lower. I say tends to because, yeah, as you may have seen in recent weeks in the markets, government bonds particularly have had a pretty hard time. And they've been pretty volatile, particularly in the UK with sort of the mini budget and things like that. So the adage is they are a lot less volatile than shares. That's not to say that they always will be, but typically they're a lot less volatile because, as I said, governments and very large corporations seldom go bankrupt or default on their promises to pay the interest and the original amount back.
Okay, so I just wanted to touch on that a little bit, because of course when you're thinking about, you know, ultimately what you want to invest in, you kind of, those are your big options really. It's kind of cash, bonds and shares sort of dial up the risk a little bit, would you say? And then some of those other asset classes kind of dial it down. Is that how you were kind of forming a portfolio for yourself?
Yes and no. I'd say that shares are more risky in the short term, but over the long term, shares, the fact that shares have outperformed every other asset class means that actually over the longer term, shares are the least risky option. So in the short term, whilst they will go up and down a lot more than bonds and things like that, over the long term, if you're not taking that risk to benefit from the longer term growth they offer, it's actually a big risk on you because you're missing out on potential gains. So over the short term, yes, it makes sense to have a diversified portfolio. But over the longer term, the more shares you have is actually the lower risk option.
Interesting. Of course, especially in an environment of inflation, which is eating away at the purchasing power of money, it makes sense that you want to be in assets that have the potential to grow above that level of inflation, right? And that's what shares kind of offer you.
Absolutely. I mean, the adage with shares, at least keeping pace with inflation, is take a supermarket, for example. They are listed companies. as inflation goes up, they put up their prices. You and I, as the consumer, have to buy food because otherwise we die. So we pay the higher prices. That feeds into higher company profits, and that feeds into a higher share price in pace with inflation. So that's the theory as to why shares always keep pace with inflation. It doesn't always usually work that simply and that nicely. But over the long run, yes, stocks typically do keep pace with inflation.
Just finally on this point, then, how do feelings, when you're sort of thinking about those goals and you're thinking about some of these assets, how do your feelings around risk-taking, risk aversion come into this?
So a big part of your feelings towards risk will be your attitudes to money that are entrenched at a really young age. And you need to consider that taking no risk, or the perceived lack of taking any risk, is a really big risk itself. As we already discussed, inflation is a big eroder of the purchasing power of your money over time. And it's a silent risk. So if you think, I can't afford to see my money go up and down in the stock market, but I want to hold all my money in cash, over time, you're accepting that you're going to lose a huge swathe of money. So you need to get into your mind that there is no such thing as no risk, and there is only managed risk. And it's how you react and act to any risks that arise. And as long as you know you've got a sensible approach, you know that you're going to have the best outcome for you. So it really, if you are uncertain, it does make sense to speak to a financial planner who will be able to help sort of gauge your attitude to risk and also coach you through the process of why you should have some assets that can go up and down more than some others. But it would depend on what your goals are. And as I said, if you've got an immediate goal in the short term, really you shouldn't be taking any risk with that money, because you know you've got a sum that you can't afford to lose, and that inflation over that time is going to be minor. But over the longer term, if you aren't taking any risk, you're going to be worse off for it. So you do need to make sure you're taking risk for the right time frames.
Okay, so risk is something that's important. It's how we gain a return. These risks can be managed. Things like diversification and, you know, having a balanced portfolio is how we kind of manage some of these risks. But if you've got a real issue with it, if you know that you're going to be lying in bed awake at night worrying about your money running around in the stock markets, a financial advisor can actually help you with that and give you a bit of comfort, basically.
Yes, and help coach you through your own emotions. I mean, at first, it is like, you know, riding a bike. You can't do it at first, and going into the stock market and seeing it go up and down will be scary. But as you go through, you know, the stock market investing experience, after over time, you will realize that, you know, markets do go down, but they also go up. And that is, you know, you've got to get comfortable with that idea, and it will come more naturally the longer you do it.
Okay, let's get on to step 3. And this is actually forming this investment plan. What does it comprise then, Felix?
So the investment plan, I would firstly to build on that first step, which was you've got all your assets. So you've got, you know what you've got. And it's a very key part of the investment plan. The next step would be, what are my goals? So you've got your goals. You need to order those. So you need to think about what you want to do and how important each one of those are to your life, effectively. The next step in that plan would be some sort of financial contingency planning. So as I sort of touched on the protection angle, what's going to happen if you can't work, if your partner can't work, if you die, if your partner dies, and making sure you've got adequate protection in place for those horrible scenarios that you hope never happen, but they do happen to people. So being prepared for them is a very important step in formulating the financial plan. And the next step, after you've done all that, is to review what you already have. Is it appropriate to meet your goals? If it can't meet your goals, what are you going to look at to change to try and meet your goals? Or, you know, with your surplus income, how are you going to best divert that to meet your goals at set timeframes? So that would be something that you need to think about. And it's where you start thinking about, where am I going to invest my money? What wrappers am I going to invest in? Am I going to invest in an ISA, a pension, a portfolio, just cash accounts? So they're the type of things that you'll then start to think about once you've got that core basis to your financial plan.
When you say protection, what kind of protection is available?
So with protection, the typical one that everyone's heard of is life insurance. So that simply pays out a sum to your family if you die prematurely, and you pay a premium each month for that. There's also critical illness cover, and that can pay out if you get diagnosed with a named critical illness. The list is basically getting bigger all the time, so the chance of you getting one that isn't on the list is very slim. And again, that would help with, say, if you had to have ongoing care costs that weren't covered by the NHS, for example. That's why you'd have critical illness protection. Another one is income protection insurance. So that protects your income, or usually two-thirds of your income, if you can't do your job for whatever reason, long-term illness or things like that. So they're the type of protection products you'd look at and make sure you've got in place to cover any eventuality. And some people will have those through their employer anyway. So that's pretty good.
Okay. And then we get down to the point where we've got some goals and we know we've got some money each month that we can afford to invest or save or whatever it is in order to get to those goals. How do you then start thinking about the investments you make? And let's pick a goal that we're all going to have, and that's retiring. And let's pick an age, let's say you're 40 years old. How do you then start to think about what kind of assets that you should invest in if, let's say, you have £100 a month that you want to put into your pension?
Okay, so if you're, say, we'll take a 40-year-old, for example, typically they're going to retire at their state pension age, which may be age 67. So they've got 27 years to invest their money. So my first thing would be thinking, how comfortable are they with stock market risk? And what do they already have in their workplace pension? So the first thing I would check in that instance is, if their employer pays in to the pension scheme as well, which most will, if you pay in more, does your employer pay in more? So that's the first thing I check to make that £100 go extra far, if you like, because if I can add my £100 to my employer pension and my employer is going to pay in more, it's a win-win. So that's the first thing I check. The next thing I then consider is looking at sort of the funds available within my workplace pension that are available to me, because workplace pensions have very low fees, but the fund options often aren't as wide as elsewhere. But that's the first place I'd look, just to make sure that, you know, if there is a fund that meets my goal there, I can pick that and leave it. And it's very simple. If not, I'd have to look at a pension that I could self-invest myself, as a SIP, for example, a self-invested personal pension. And then I'd start to look at the funds that are out there, investment trusts and things like that. And I can select one that my money will go into each month. And over time, that will invest my money and grow.
Okay. And would you say, because you've got that 27 years, that what you can afford to do is to go into stock market risk, to buy some company shares and kind of look at those assets and afford to take a bit of risk because you know you've got quite a long time frame in order to see those investments play out?
Yeah, that's generally what I'd suggest. I'd err on the side of caution, though, for picking individual stocks. I'd always look at a fund. So there are two types of funds that are available. You've got passive funds, and what they simply do is buy every stock on a given market with no discrimination. So good companies, bad companies, they buy all of it and hold it. So that's the first type. They're very, very cheap because they need no active input by a human. And then the second type is you have active funds. Now, active funds are where you will invest in a fund manager will then pick stocks that they think are going to outperform the market as a whole. So there's pros and cons for both. Active funds are, of course, more costly because there's a human involved in picking and actually monitoring the portfolio. But active managers should come into their prime in more volatile market conditions. But passive funds, again, give you very cheap access. And if you have no idea of what fund to pick or what sort of area you want to invest in, buying a passive fund is a really good way of just making sure you are participating in the market. So making sure you're in it rather than out of it because you don't know what to do is the more important thing.
And then, that's, you know, we sort of formed a bit of a plan. We've got going in the stock market. We are going with our investments. Then you kind of have a final stage, and that's what you call the review stage. You want to explain what this is?
So the review stage, once you've done your financial plan, is I review it annually just to make sure that you are still sticking to your plan and seeing if there are any tweaks to be made to it. You've got different goals, different priorities. But the absolute crucial thing I would say is stick to your financial plan. If the markets go down and that's not going to impact your you know future goals or your plans, don't react negatively to that. So you really need to be aware and be watchful of reacting yourself when you are reviewing your plan. So just make sure once a year you go through, am I still on track to meet my goals? Do I need to rejig things a little bit to because I prioritize things in a slightly different order? Because you will change your goals as you go through life. But making sure you are sticking to the plan and why the plan is, you know, created in the first place is probably the best part of the review, just making sure that you're on track.
So in when you see bear markets coming along, you wouldn't suggest changing things at all, just stick to the plan and keep going.
Exactly, sticking to the plan. And that's where financial planners can add so much value. Regardless of what a financial planner's fee is, that value of helping you stick to your plan is often intangible, but actually it can be invaluable in terms of the benefit you get. Because if you react negatively at the wrong time, it can really sort of dampen your future return prospects or your future ability to meet your goals. So making sure that you stick to your plan, even if markets go down, knowing that you set this up for a reason and you can afford to leave it and everything else at the beginning, is usually the right thing to do.
Well, on that note, Felix Milton, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, a very big thank you to Felix Milton for joining me and talking about forming an investment plan. I hope you found that useful. Of course, don't hesitate to drop me a line at marcus@stepstoinvesting.com if you've got any questions. Next time around, in a fortnight's time, we're going to be speaking to Myron Jobson from Interactive Investor. He's the senior personal finance analyst there, and he's going to be talking to us about what is said in next week's autumn statement. So what ramifications it might have for us and our finances, and of course, any investing that we might do. Until next time, goodbye.